Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Isger. I am joined by, it's the Fab Four today, guys. It's David French, Steve Hayes, Jonah Goldberg. For a bit of year in review, we weren't even actually supposed to have this podcast, but all of us wanted to do it anyway, instead of taking the day off. I don't know what's wrong with us, but here we all are, and we're going to keep it light. We're just going to talk about the year in review and see where it goes. I honestly, at this moment, have no idea.
And we should say, I mean, it is a little bit like the Brady Bunch where they was like, we can put the show on right here. I don't have a huge amount of preparation for the year in review, but I was around for this year, so I assume something will come to me. So,
and so we will review your year, Jonah. Let's dive right in.
This is your life.
It's interesting as we think about the year in review, because perhaps one of the more consequential things that happened in 2022 happened this week with President Zelensky in his first trip speaking to U.S. Congress. Do you think that warrants top tier year in review status? Was it consequential?
I mean, it does. I think it was a big moment. I think the speech was awfully compelling, but it's sort of the culmination of what 10 months of an important story in 2022, and that's the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's amazing how much has happened since that invasion, and how much in some ways it's faded from our day-to-day news consumption. It was a story that dominated reporting and dominated coverage at certainly in the immediate aftermath of the invasion. But even as Ukraine has done, I think, surprisingly well by any measure, it's been a big story. I would argue that it's certainly one of the biggest stories of the year, but it hasn't dominated American news as it might have, given, I think, its importance.
Can I divide that also up into the foreign policy, obviously international implications of the news story, and what it's highlighted of our domestic politics? I mean, even this week in our U.S. Congress, you saw the divide within the Republican Party, or the divide between Republicans and Democrats on foreign policy questions now in a way that 15 years ago in the post 9/11 world would have been very strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was actually reading our morning dispatch coverage of the Zelensky speech this morning, and we had at the end of the item that we wrote about the Zelensky speech was a big picture look at the speech and what's been happening in Russia, as well as a mention of the domestic political angle here. And on the one hand, when I got to that part of the item, I thought, it's really unfortunate that in a story about something as significant as an unprovoked Russian invasion of Ukraine, and Zelensky's traveling to the United States to give this momentous address, we have to make reference to Donald Trump Jr.'s stupid ass tweet about Zelensky. it bothers me that that's part of the story. And I will acknowledge my first inclination was to cut it. Like, why do we care about what Donald Trump Jr. is saying about Volodymyr Zelensky? Trump Jr. is, you know, sort of a sniveling ne'er-do-well. And Zelensky is a war hero. And I left it in. And I think in retrospect, Price Sinclair, who's the reporter who wrote it up, was not only smart to include it, but it really had to be there. Because I do think part of the story is what's happening in the Republican Party and the rise of people like Donald Trump Jr. And the arguments that they're making. It's not even arguments. You can't even dignify them so much as to say that there are arguments being made about Zelensky and about Russia and Ukraine. It's just sort of taking shots. And, you know, you had 86 of what, 214 Republicans show up for the speech. Most of them, I think, who showed up applauded and or were at least polite. Some of them didn't. Some of them made a show performing as usual, not standing up. But it is this divide in the Republican Party. And look, I think, and we've talked about it on this podcast before, there are strong, I don't find them persuasive, but there are strong, principled, non-interventionist arguments to be made. There are good arguments to be made about the lack of transparency on how some of this money is being spent. We're not getting those, by and large, from the Republicans who oppose this. It's just performative nonsense. And I think that's, unfortunately, it really is part of the story.
Well, David, let's leave the Russia-Ukraine story for a moment. Year in review, what is the second, let's say, largest international story? Is it China's COVID up and down? Is it Iran? Is it, what is it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in terms of the actual consequence to human lives, ultimately, Chinese bungling of COVID is going to be the bigger story. And, you know, it's so hard to know what's happening there. It's so hard to know how many people have died there already, how many people are sick. But the reports that we're seeing are really bad. And it's not just that, okay, they just went from zero COVID to something approximating letter rip. It's also that they had done it for 2 years. They had shut out, you know, American vaccines. They had shut out a lot of the treatments that we had developed and have decided to go it alone. And now the human cost and the human toll that they're paying is pretty staggering. But a lot of this stuff, both Iran and China, it feels to me like we could be talking in a few months and the stories could either be extremely consequential that are unfolding right now or a blip. Does Iran get its protests under control? Has this been just yet another wave of protests that kinds of flows and then ebbs? Or does China get its COVID outbreak under control? Are its vaccines and treatments effective enough to keep a true crisis from happening? These are all things that are sort of unfolding right now and we don't know. But if I had to guess what's happening in China, it's just in terms of pure human cost is going to be the next biggest thing. And then the potential fallout from that, the reaction to that of such bungling on a colossal scale. I mean, what kind of fallout will there be? So it feels like we're on the front end of these things, maybe, and don't really know. But if I had to guess, I'm going to say China.
Jonah, there were some other international headlines that I'm curious, trend line, like forget just this year. I want you to like spread out, give me like a 10-year vantage here. But, you know, since the 2008 financial crisis, the rise of Donald Trump in the United States has been mirrored by similar type populist movements internationally. Right now in the United States, we seem to have maybe reached the peak of that. Maybe Donald Trump's popularity is waning. Maybe the overall vibes around nationalism, populism are receding a little. And I'm curious how we think of that with Italy's election, the, coup attempt in Germany. Do we think, or the head of lettuce in London, in the UK, what do we think is happening internationally on that larger scale?
Yeah. Having just gotten back from Turkey's.
Oh, Israel. Still, I forgot Israel, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. So we've talked about this a bunch of times. There's this pretty well-established finding in social science that says that financial crises in particular that cause major, if not depressions, then recessions and financial dislocations can have real long tail populist effects. And I'm still of the belief that you mentioned, you know, the financial crisis 2007, 2008. I still think a lot of the politics of the last decade and plus are that was the, as they say in Latin, the fons et origo of much of the nonsense that we have today. And I think it's playing out in different parts of the globe in different ways. And there's a social contagion thing that comes from populist movements. At the same time, picking up on David's point about China and the question about Iran and all that, I think that I just wrote a comment about this. I think this has been a very bad year for authoritarianism. It's been a pretty good year for specific authoritarians, but that's a different thing. The, you know, probably the smartest and only interesting thing that Osama bin Laden ever said was that little disquisition on the strong horse versus the weak horse and how people are generally gravitate towards successful and strong models versus weak and unsuccessful ones. And I don't think you can look at the events of the last year and the three major authoritarian regimes of Russia, China, and Iran, or even many of the lesser ones, and say, if you don't live there, yeah, that's the kind of country I want to live in. You know, like China, it's very interesting. China, Xi has gotten himself into this really bad cul-de-sac where he's at the loser's lunch table with his alliance with Putin, and he doesn't really want to be there, but he's got no choice. And if you look at the sort of alliances of authoritarian regimes out there, it's really just, it's the crappy Hong Kong knockoff of countries. It's not the group that you want to hang out with. It's not the kind of place that you would want your children to grow up in. And I think that the popular protests in China over the COVID restrictions that were in large part, not entirely, and maybe not, you know, mostly, but significantly inspired by images of people enjoying themselves at the World Cup, tells you that there is still a real bourgeois, small d democratic desire to live normal lives in a normal country among the vast stretches of the middle class in China. And that is something that the West can work with. And so, yeah, bad things happen in Indonesia. Bad things are happening in lots of places. Putin isn't about to be kicked out of power or anything like that. But if example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other, then I think that the West is looking much better on everything from COVID and economics on down. And that's really important because you have to actually show people sometimes that authoritarian sucks. You can't just tell them.
Last question on that, Steve. The Taliban and the story of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. And David, you're welcome to jump in on this too. But you know, the last piece of major news for 2022 is that universities there will no longer be educating women. I don't think this is shocking to anyone, but it's both disappointing, obviously, but is it a harbinger that we're just heading back to where we were, that we're going to, I don't know, repeat history, if you will, or at least rhyme it?
It's the end of 2022 and you're still trying to get my Taliban piece from the much discussed.
It's only been 3 years. I mean, I'm expecting it to be really great.
Never yet written Taliban piece. I apologize. Yeah, it's a really discouraging bit of news. Again, this week, sort of it seems like a number of these stories that we've been following for the year or for longer than a year culminate in this week with additional bad news. None of this is surprising. Of course, this is what the Taliban was going to do. This is who the Taliban are. I think it in retrospect makes some of the hopeful comments we heard from Zalkalizad before the withdrawal, Biden and then Trump's envoy to the Taliban for these peace negotiations look ever more naive. I mean, I think they were pretty naive at the time, but they read even more naive now. Even some of the comments, the Biden administration didn't go too far in its rhetoric around the withdrawal, sort of holding out hope for a reformed Taliban, but left the possibility open in a way that I think also was naive. But no, it's a tragedy. I mean, you'd seen school enrollment, I think higher education enrollment, if I'm remembering correctly, spiked to something like 9 million Afghans, and 3+ million of those were women. That's quadrupling in a just a short amount of time. And now it's looking like that's not going to happen. There was a protest yesterday, I believe, in Kabul, where women were rounded up for protesting this, and some of them disappeared. It's a trend. I think it's where Afghanistan is going. We have seen some of the predictions come true about Afghanistan sort of growing in its place as a safe harbor for Al-Qaeda and like-minded jihadists, ISIS, Khorasan. So I think it's a bad news story. It's a bad development on a human rights level. I think it also could be a very bad development on a security level.
All right, David, we're changing course entirely. And I'm coming to you for this question and not Jonah, for reasons everyone listening to this will understand. What was the best moment of the year? Not personally, by the way. I know what your best moment of the year was. You put it on Instagram.
True. What was the best moment of the year? Oh, so you're asking me that question.
Yeah.
About specifically. Okay.
Yeah, I want happiness. And when I want happiness, yes, I come to David French and not Jonah Goldberg.
What? Well, the best moment of the year in our family was Nancy French on the main stage of the Alice Tully Theater of the Lincoln Center, telling a story for The Moth, which is a storytelling group that'll... It's funny when you tell people, when you ask people, do you know what The Moth is? People either say no or yes and love it. It's a storytelling group. And she told the story of our early relationship and a almost terrible misunderstanding and case of mistaken identity, in where I was briefly confused for David Lee Roth. It's a great story. It was a great moment for us. And yes, I did put it on Instagram. And because, yeah, it's not every day that you see your wife on the main stage of the Lincoln Center.
All right. So what was the best moment for the country then?
The best moment for the country. It's going to be the best moment for the country. I've got two contenders, and one of them I think is actually going to be far more historically. One is the jury is much more still out on it, and the other one is, I think, much more likely to be relevant. And it's
going to be
actually.
Oh no, I'm worried you're picking mine. Actually, let's see. Okay.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, I'm definitely not picking yours. It's okay. Actually going to be the defeat of the Russians outside of Kyiv was actually the best moment for us as well.
Oh.
That had Zelensky left, had Ukraine fallen in the 24 to 48 hours that Putin anticipated, the world would be a very different and very much darker place right now. And I don't think we've even fully comprehended and grasped how different and how darker it would be. How much darker it would be, how much it would impact our domestic politics, how much it would impact NATO. The victory that Putin anticipated he was going to have would have been catastrophic. The other thing is, look, every one of the Trump-endorsed MAGA candidates in the big statewide swing state elections lost, every one of them. And it was so clear and so obvious that like only publications like The Federalist could mistake the signs for what was happening. This was completely clearly a critical mass of Americans, not a majority of Republicans, but a critical mass of Republicans were saying no to all of the, the MAGA craziness out there. And the reason why I'm contingent about it is, well, we're already kind of sort of in a presidential primary where Donald Trump is still kind of sort of maybe a front runner. So all of that sort of taste of victory can turn into ashes soon enough. So I don't know how consequential, but for now, that was a very consequential development.
Unfortunately, all of that turns out to be wrong. The best moments for the country is a three-way tie. Though, again, I think one of them will turn out to be more consequential than the other three. The Artemis launch from NASA.
Oh, yes.
To return astronauts to the moon. The new images we had from the James Webb telescope were incredible. And obviously, the breakthrough we had in fusion energy obviously, I think will be the most impactful, not just on our country, but on humanity. This is, you know, I think plenty of people have said the way forward on climate change and anything else is going to be through technology, not through trying to tell everyone to stop doing what they're doing. That was never going to be a sustainable strategy on climate change, Paris Accords notwithstanding. And this is actually the way forward. And after so much time and money and everything else, boy, it is incredibly inspiring when we have major scientific breakthroughs with teams of, you know, human primates paving the way. So congrats to that
team.
Can
I just say, you're right. It's the crack of dawn when we record this in Nashville time. And so
it's about 10 a.m. Eastern.
Crack of dawn, Nashville. I said Nashville time. Uh-huh. And so Artemis and Fusion. Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Yes. Right. Sorry.
Wow. Nashville really is the new California.
Steve, best moments?
Actually, I was persuaded by the one that David just walked away from. I thought he made a very good argument about the non-fall of Kyiv.
I'm still including Kyiv, but yeah, I'm adding Artemis and Fusion.
Certainly, I think that was really an incredible moment, and overall, the strength of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian resistance has been pretty amazing. I would say, sort of piggybacks on what David argued about the midterms, I think you sort of set that begins earlier, and it begins with the hearings of the January 6th committee, which I think were tremendously important for the country. I think it mattered to have people who worked directly for Donald Trump, who had devoted their careers in many cases to supporting and strengthening Donald Trump's career, testify either in transcribed interviews, in recorded depositions, or sometimes live in front of the country in these hearings, to tell the country what I think most everybody knew, but was important to hear from them, which was the election was not stolen. Donald Trump knew that the election was not stolen. He knew it very early in the process. This whole thing was made up for weeks and weeks, culminating in the attacks on January 6th. And most Republicans, I think, came to believe that it was BS. That process, the fact that it came out, I think, sort of painstakingly through those hearings, and again, that it was Republicans who were the ones who were offering not their theories, not their speculation, not conspiracies, but facts based on what they witnessed, is important to begin the turn away from the crazy that we've experienced over the past 7-8 years.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from Tax Network USA. Do you owe back taxes? Pandemic relief is now over. Along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. Don't waive your rights and speak with them on your own. They are not your friends. Tax Network USA, a trusted tax relief firm, has saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best possible deal. Whether you owe $10,000 or $10 million, they can help you. Whether it's business or personal taxes, even if you have the means to pay or you are on a fixed income, they can help financially resolve your tax burdens once and for all. Call 1-800-245-6000 for a private, free consultation or visit tnusa.com/dispatch.
All right, Jonah, I hope you have something spider related for me.
Can I get a clarification? Are these like rah-rah best for America moments or most important moments? Because we seem to be going back and forth on
I wanted rah-rah best for America moments.
That's what I thought you were asking for, and I don't have any, but I just was kind of curious if that's what you were looking for.
Good clarification, Jonah.
I agree with David that the nature is healing stuff is real about our politics. It's going to be a slow process with lots of fits and starts and backslides and all that kind of stuff. But I will say, and this is, I was holding on to the Fusion thing for a bunch of different categories because I think it's a really, really big deal, but you covered that.
We can cover it the whole podcast. I will do an entire podcast about how important this is.
Nah.
more important in the near term. Near term is the wrong term. Then like the telescope stuff and all of that is the fact that we had a successful test of an asteroid nudging rocket. Mm. And as someone
Jonah,
who's
thinking
every,
back to the 1997 set of blockbuster movies.
as someone who every now and then checks in on how we're doing on this issue, the chances of we're getting much better. Like we're actually looking at more and more sky. Like when I first started reading and writing about this, like 20 years ago, we weren't looking for this stuff. And there was a non-trivial chance that a planet-destroying asteroid could come and smack into us. And the fact that we are actually making significant progress, both in spotting and in nudging these, because you can't, the planet killers, you can't really blow up. And maybe you don't want to, because then you just get a whole bunch of mini planet killers. But if you can just nudge them a little bit, and we successfully nudged an asteroid this year, which is a really, really big deal, and deserves its attention.
Two things on that. One, we always have Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck, Billy Bob Thornton. I'm just not that concerned based on the documentary that I've seen on it. But
have you ever seen Affleck talk about this, that movie? There's these great clips from the director's cut where they interview him or whatever. And he's like, I still don't understand why we couldn't train astronauts to drill, but we could train drillers to be astronauts.
It's a great movie. It is so amazing.
Even our year in review episode gets like hijacked by the sci-fi dork squad.
That is not a sci-fi movie.
Like, Jerry Bruckheimer is not sci-fi.
Michael Bayness. Like, it is so good.
You strap a sci-fi nerd into a chair and make him watch that movie, they would burst into flames.
I'm not talking about just that movie. It's now we're off into all of this sci-fi becomes real. That's what you all think is the greatest thing this year.
Fine. Steve, sit it out for another 3 minutes, because Jonah, the thing that I want to hear you talk about, I agree with you that nudging the asteroid is all well and good, but that was like a really small percentage chance, all things considered. The space junk crisis that we are heading toward is not a small chance. It is inevitable. And I have not heard great plans for that. So maybe we now transition into, you know, worst moments. Worst moment, like fusion is more important, but we still have to solve the space junk problem.
Yeah, but the space junk wasn't a bad moment. The space junk thing, I think, is a near-term challenge, but long-term, we're going to fix that, right? We're going to come up with some giant robotic hockey goalie that just smacks that stuff into Earth's gravitational pull, and then it burns up in the atmosphere. And like that's fixable. I don't know, worst moments of the year. I'm gonna have to think about it for a second. Steve, who's always his true superpower is always looking for the worst case scenario for things, probably has a long list of worst moments ready to go.
His hair was out of place one morning.
You can see my hair right now. It's out of place again.
The Haze strategic cheese curd supply was down to 10%.
This is the abuse I get.
So, Steve?
I don't have an obvious worst moment. I do think there have been lots of them, not surprisingly.
The problem for me is that you constantly sort of have a proximity problem. So I'm thinking of things that are happening in the last, you know, 2 months or whatever. Yeah. But I gotta say, I think that the Kanye West Nick Fuentes dinner with a former president was pretty bad.
Not great. Not great.
And just sort of it wasn't by itself. It wasn't in isolation. You have this overall rise in anti-Semitism happening, along with a nationalist movement that is, I think it's waning in terms of its popularity, maybe gross numbers, but it's also increasing in terms of its strength within a decreasing number of Americans, if that makes sense. David, is that making any sense to you?
narrowing, but intensifying.
Yeah. And so we're, you know, not only are the raw numbers of anti-Semitic, you know, crimes, et cetera, going up, but then you're having these major U.S. figures embracing, cuddling with, footsie, you know, maybe anti-Semitism is great. And you have that on the right, and it's a different type of anti-Semitism than you have on the left. But of course, on the left, we've had increasing rising anti-Semitism at universities and in speech stuff. I mean, you and I have talked on advisory opinions about some of the cases that are coming out of that. And so when you have both the right and the left in different fashions embracing Jewish discrimination, like, man, we already did that.
So maybe we should not make it moments, but trends.
Okay. Right?
'Cause, I mean, like,
okay, well, I have a moment. I have a moment that's also a trend. And I would say the Uvalde school shooting was, has to be, if not the low point, certainly one of the low points. And, you know, it was horrific for what it was, of course. And then the more you learned about it, it was just compounded day after day after day. And you worry that we're not learning lessons in all the finger pointing in the aftermath.
I went to tour a preschool for the Brisket recently, and the first thing that they started talking about on that tour was the school's hardening strategies, both pre and post Uvalde. I mean, I am able at least to talk about it now without crying, as listeners of this and other podcasts may remember. But yeah, I mean, that was like, it was too worst a moment of the year for me to even bring up. David?
Yeah, it's as Steve said, it was the Uvalde shooting, and then all of the fallout. You know, it was one of these stories that from the first moments is horrific, and you didn't think it could get worse, and it just kept getting worse. And it still does, by the way. I mean, like, there's literally nothing you learn as the law enforcement response is being explored and investigated. There's like nothing that you learn that makes it any better. It's one of the most staggering law enforcement failures in the history of the United States unfolded. And it's simply stunning. And then the other thing is worst moment. If one of the best moments was the defense of Kyiv, the worst moment, the attack on Ukraine. I mean, this is a humanitarian tragedy. And we talk about, you know, and we rightly credit Ukraine for incredible courage. And they have demonstrated incredible courage. And we rightly credit Ukraine for an incredible military, an incredible defense and counteroffensive against the Russian attack. But when you really dive into what Ukraine has lost, it's staggering. I mean, the amount of civilian deaths, the amount of military deaths, the total demolition of their economy, the refugees, both displaced outside of their borders and internally displaced. It's just a cataclysm. And it's a cataclysm that's unfolding right in front of our eyes. And the only thing that sort of turns it into a bright spot is that we didn't expect the level of conviction and the level of courage that was demonstrated, but it's still horror piled upon horror.
Can I give a version of that actually also, which is that we're, you know, at basically 1,000 people this year who have died crossing the border, the southern border. And yet both sides of our political spectrum use the immigration issue for basically talking points only. And at the same time, just the amount of human suffering going on, the cartels that are being enriched through their human smuggling operations, the number of repeat crossers. And I'm not laying any blame, because that's the whole problem, is that we want to spend so much more time talking about whose fault it is that we haven't fixed that problem. And I don't think we spend nearly enough time talking about, frankly, what the problem is, aside from oh, look, we have a record number of people crossing into the country illegally. There's a cost to that as well, more than just a list of grievances.
So, what made me want to change it to trends rather than moments was the border crisis. Because, like, how many record-breaking days do we have where the border crisis got worse? And
all
the
of
utter
them. I mean, every single month broke records, and not just records from the previous year, or previous couple of years, like since we've started keeping track.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And, but sort of going back to the anti-Semitism thing, which I'm not going to talk specifically about anti-Semitism, it seems to me if we're looking for like bad trends that were really on display throughout this year and really throughout this last decade, but more to the point for the last year, is it's a hard thing to figure out the right term for it, but it's basically that the seems to me that the binding power of moral dogma is going out the window.
Yeah.
Right? There is this society sort of depend on, you know, I've been writing about this for 20 years. People claim that they don't like dogmatic people. They don't like dogma. You know, you shouldn't be dogmatic. Don't be open-minded. And my typical response to that is screw you. Because dogma is actually hugely important. Dogma is this basic concept that says there are certain things that just don't need to be debated. They don't even need to be questioned. We just take them as a given. Comes from the Greek, meaning like seems good, you know, just appears to be the good thing. I'm dogmatically opposed to torture of puppies. I'm dogmatically opposed to pedophilia. We can list, I'm dogmatically opposed to premeditated murder, right? We are all dogmatic about these kinds of things. And it's good that we are. It's, you know, and that's why it's always so exhausting when people say, oh, you know, they're just asking questions. Let's talk about whether Jews have so much power or whether the Holocaust actually happened, right? You know, we're just asking questions. It's like, yeah, but some questions shouldn't be asked, right? It's like, we shouldn't revisit the question of slavery. We should be dogmatically opposed to slavery and move on from the question. And when you look at our politics today, so much of it is, well, there's nothing stopping me from being a jackass. There's nothing stopping me from violating the Constitution in principle, right? I mean, like whether it's the student loan thing or all the stuff that Trump did. And it's like, it's as if people realize there's no policeman standing nearby that will enforce proper behavior and proper, discourse. And so you get, and social media, I think, is the thing that accelerates it, where you get everybody just feeling like, why not say this? Why not throw it out there? That idiot fashion company that had toddlers in bondage, right? Because everyone is so addicted to this idea that I have to be questioning, I have to be testing norms and testing taboos and going there. And that's the problem with our culture today and our politics and our culture generally is that everybody wants to be a rebel and a maverick when the most rebellious and maverick-like thing you could do is actually behave like a responsible, decent person who does their job appropriately in and out of office.
All right. Let's see what else we have. What did we learn this year, David?
What did we learn this year? Man, not enough would be the short answer. I'm going to go back to a previous theme about some of the positive thawing in American politics is that one of the things that we might have learned is that exhausted majority still votes. And I think it was learned a little bit on the left and the right, to be frank. We had some pretty important developments earlier in the year with the San Francisco school board recalls. With the recall of the DA in San Francisco, we had no one could say this was a conservative backlash in San Francisco, right? You could get all of the conservatives in San Francisco and you wouldn't fill a phone booth. This was progressives backlashing against hyper-progressives and trying to restore some sanity to their city politics. We had backlashes in Georgia, in Arizona, in state after state, where people who had no business running for public office lost races that, frankly, was going to be hard to lose. And they lost anyway. I mean, the Kerry Lake loss was really particularly interesting to me because her opponent barely campaigned. The election was a referendum on Kerry Lake, and she lost a race that, you know, 4 years earlier, Doug Ducey had won in a Democratic wave year by about, what, 14 or 15 points. And so this was, I think, one of the things that we learned was that exhausted majority of Americans that have been found and researched to be people on both sides of the political spectrum who are kind of fed up but don't really participate in the day-to-day toxic give and take of American politics, they still show up at the voting booth. And while politicians may orient their day-to-day to the extremely toxic voices they hear from, that's a mistake. That's a mistake over the long term. And that exhausted majority might just get more active yet. So that's something that I think we've learned.
David, always the optimist. I want to give the flip side of that coin of what we learned that I'm concerned about and that I think will have potentially medium-term consequences in our politics, which is that the Chuck Schumer super PAC strategy of pumping money into your opponent's primaries in order to get the worst opponent so that your team can win was incredibly effective. So of the, he spent about $53 million, six of those candidates moved on to the general election, and his record was 100%. All of those candidates were then defeated in the general election by Democrats. And so while on the one hand, plenty of Democrats across the ideological spectrum criticized this strategy, you know, you had the January 6th committee and every national Democrat talking about democracy being on the ballot in 2022, at the same time that you had Chuck Schumer's super PAC explicitly funding the very people they said were the biggest threats, the argument being they would be easier to beat, but it was a hell of a gamble. And to have that work, I think is pretty damaging. And obviously we knew it had worked before. Claire McCaskill did this with Todd Akin back in the day. She spent more money to get Todd Akin as her opponent in the general election than Todd Akin spent on Todd Akin. Interestingly, Chuck Schumer spent more money in several of these races than the candidate themselves had to spend as well. So it's not that it was the first time it was tried, but to do it at scale, to do it nationally, and to do it in so many races, I fear that the lesson learned is that this is effective. It's relatively easy. There's money to do it. And there was no voter backlash because how could there be? Even if you don't like the tactic, your option is to vote for the crazy person. And so what you could end up have happening is that both parties spend now hundreds of millions of dollars in the other party's primary so that general election voters are left with not the lesser of two evils, but the lesser of two totally unacceptable options. And, it's not the Republican primary voters don't play a role in that. They obviously did. But it's important to realize Chuck Schumer wasn't running ads. Hey, this person denies that the 2020 election was fair. Instead, what the ads say is this person's very, very conservative. And so I think it's important to realize that the information that Republican primary voters were getting wasn't the information that the rest of the voters were going to get during the general election when they did pour money right into saying what their actual record is. So that's a lesson that I think we learned that was bad. Steve?
Yeah, I mean, so jumping on that, I think in terms of media coverage of politics, I think politicians have learned that they really don't need the media in the way that they did running, you know, statewide campaigns 10 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago. And the result is sort of the further irrelevance of gatekeepers. So you have all of these elected officials or would-be elected officials building their own brands, launching their own media products, reaching voters directly without interference from journalists. And in some respects, as somebody who's railed on media, ideological media bias, left-wing media bias for 30 years, you'd think that this might be a good thing. I'm afraid it's not that much of a good thing because there so many of these politicians are not subject to having their ideas tested, having their claims measured, challenging the accuracy of the things that they're saying in a way that I think is really distorting our political debates. If you look at sort of the audience for podcasts that are hosted by politicians these days, where again they can say whatever they want. There's no fear or concern on their part that they're going to be challenged on these podcasts. It's just this platform. And I think the net result, at least in the short term, has been that our discussions and debates are the worse off for it because there's so little corrective.
So it's interesting you bring this up because just this morning I had this weird epiphany. So maybe this is a thing I learned this year. I was watching Morning Joe for reasons having to do with Original Sin. And they had some Democratic congressman, I can't remember his name. It was fine. He was fine, whatever, talking about Zelensky's speech. And I just sort of asked myself, why are they having any Republican congressman come on this thing? And then I realized something that was probably obvious to Sarah a while back, but like, you know, we've all heard from politicians in private about how they, you know, of course they don't like Trump, but they don't like to jump to the mainstream media's, you know, call every single time, you know, Chuck Todd says, will you denounce what Trump said yesterday? They don't want to have to do it every single time, right? You know, and that kind of thing. And it dawned on me that this small thing probably has a big thing to do with the polarization of media. Where if you're a moderate Republican and you'd love to come on and talk about Postal Service reform or Zelensky's speech or a thousand other things, but you're not going to go on MSNBC or CNN if you know the first question is going to be, Donald Trump tweeted last night like an escaped monkey from a cocaine study and said X. And so you just don't go on, right? And so that sort of big sort that we've seen in media for a long time now was actually really accelerated, I think, by this dynamic, by the mainstream press asking, I think, legitimate, but still kind of gotcha questions, you know, like, you know, why won't you denounce this when you said it 6 months ago, but you didn't denounce it this time? Has your opinion changed, right? It's just like, it's not worth it because it's not satisfying to the audience that is watching. And this clip is going to piss off the audience that isn't watching. So you just don't go on. And so what you get are networks that cater to one party or the other party. And it confirms this worldview that the audiences for both have, that the other party is exactly as bad and as unreasonable as we think, because they won't even come on. And I think that like one of the signs that nature is actually healed is when you start getting, because there always used to be Republican and Democratic politicians who were, I think this is the technical term in the comms world, Sarah can correct me, TV whores. And they would just go on TV. They would take any invitation to be on TV. And there are fewer of them because both sides have this institutional incentive to ask these sort of wolfsbane, silver bullet, you know, poison question that their own side wants to hear. That's just not worth addressing. And so it's a centrifugal force in this larger process. Anyway, it just was in my head this morning. So
that reminds me of that there was this joke that we'd tell in law school that the most dangerous place on campus was anywhere between Alan Dershowitz and a television camera.
Right.
There have been some politicians like that.
Well, and the same sort of theory really applies to who's running for office in the first place, of course. If you're a person who wants to talk about your serious solutions for our serious problems, why would you throw your hat in the ring at this point when any person would tell you, like, well, you're not going to get to talk about those things. That's not what a campaign looks like right now. And that's not who's getting elected right now. Do you want to, you know, go on social media and tape a video in which you, you know, stoke outrage about whatever thing that just happened in the news and blame the other side? Like, that would, that's who should run for office. And indeed, that's exactly who we have running for office. I have a much longer rant on that, but I'm going to save it. all right, let's do a little rap here.
Do you need a beat?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you meant a different kind of rap. I'm sorry. Because Steve can give you a beat.
I hate predictions, but if anyone has predictions for 2023, I'm all ears. Any takers?
I will. Well, it's not for 2023, but it's... I officially think that neither DeSantis nor Trump will be the nominee for the Republican.
I like where your head's at, Jonah.
Is a prediction. Wow. I predict that a big conversation for next year related to that, Jonah, will be what the media learned covering Trump, both in 2015, 2016, and then through his presidency, but almost to a lesser extent through the presidency, really campaign-focused coverage, and how different the 2024 cycle will look from a media and coverage perspective across the ideological spectrum. Steve?
I agree with that, in part because of what I mentioned earlier. I think the dynamic is just going to be so different. You're going to just have campaigns that don't choose to participate in a lot of the old media campaign conventions that we've all grown accustomed to. I just had one, and I totally forgot. I predict that my memory will not get better in 2023.
That's amazing. David, you go first.
I used to be skeptical about this. I'm not as skeptical. I think Donald Trump's going to be indicted. And I think that it will not rally Republicans around him. That we actually learned something from the Mar-a-Lago raid, that the burst of indignation surrounding the Mar-a-Lago raid was really pretty brief overall. And when the details kept coming out, it actually made Trump look worse and not the FBI, unlike some other scandals. But I think Trump will be indicted in 2023, and that will be the end of him as a political front runner.
What will that do to the value of Steve's Trump NFT trading cards?
I'm just going to do them with you instead in a Superman outfit. I remember buying. I was actually just going to re-up an earlier prediction related to our bet, Sarah. I don't think Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee in 2024. I don't think Joe Biden will be the Democratic nominee in 2024, even though I think it's more likely that he's going to run now than I did when I originally said that, but I don't think he'll be, either one of them will be the nominees. We'll see a big scrum on both sides.
So I still am committed to our bet because I'm a woman of my word. I will agree with you that it is certainly trending your direction, but if the Republican primaries were happening this January, and they're not, and I understand that, but if, you know, Iowa was in just a few weeks, Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee. They're trending your way, but they're not there yet. So, all right.
Do you want to go? Should we quadruple them? I mean, we doubled right now. I got two stakes coming my way.
No, because I'm agreeing.
And you've got two stakes.
I know, but it's trending your way. I'm nothing but pleased with that. But no, so I don't want to quadruple down at all. Although we could quadruple on the Biden side. We haven't done the Democratic side. I think you're wrong on that.
Okay, I'll do that. We're just going to end up going out and getting like three steaks each.
Yeah. I mean, Steve and I are going to be dining together for months, one way or the other.
So if you win on Biden and lose on Trump, does that cancel out, or do you have to go
then
on
we go Dutch.
Separate? Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, then we would just go Dutch.
I hope that's not a Dutch slur, Jonah. I need a ruling on that.
You're not supposed to say it anymore.
No, you're not.
But I mean, like, I would say it. There's no problem saying it, but there are a bunch of like usage guides from like newspapers and stuff saying that it's
actually a negative.
It's offensive.
And so it's
I'm sorry. How in the world is that offensive?
That's the thing is like, I don't think it is. I keep asking Dutch people every now and then, you know, when I run into Dutch people, I pick them up after running into them. And then I ask while they're dusting off, I ask, you know, are you offended if someone says, let's go Dutch? And they're like, no, because they may not know the expression, but like, it's just a dumb invented thing to make it seem like any ethnic stereotyping is beyond the pale, but it's supposed to suggest that, you know, Dutch people are frugal.
So it's so funny.
Beyond the pale. Think about how really pale people feel about that.
I mean, that's right.
Seriously.
I wouldn't say that. Gosh.
Perhaps growing up in Texas, I have zero understanding of any stereotypes about Dutch people. I have no picture of a Dutch person in my mind. None. I have nothing.
Me neither. Didn't reach Kentucky either, although I do remember the Nigel Powers, played by Michael Caine and Austin Powers, uh-huh, gold member. There are two kinds of people that I hate in this world. Those who are intolerant of others' cultures and the Dutch.
Well, that's like my dad's favorite quote from Russia was, if you see a Bulgarian in the street, beat him. He will know why.
It's just so odd. I wasn't even sure if it was about Dutch people. It could have been like Reagan's, you know, nickname was Dutch. Maybe it was about, I don't know, nicknames or something. But also, I wasn't even sure that it was about frugality, because one could also imagine it being about fairness.
Equity, you know, to go sure, Dutch, yeah, right.
Is to be really fair. So I didn't know if it was negative or positive or about Dutch people. I will consider that, Jonah. Before I say it next time, I don't know which way it's going to cut, though, to be honest. You just had that great newsletter on speech and banning words that are not banning, poo-pooing phrases and words that are silly. And I'm gonna take some of that to heart. But again, not sure which way it's going to cut. All right. Very last thing. Lightning round. Favorite holiday tradition. It can be an item of food. It can be, you know, the thing that's always in your stocking or the dreidel you spin. But David, we're starting with you.
Yeah, what's your favorite dreidel to spin?
My favorite dreidel to spin. That's a really good question. Christmas Eve service is always awesome. Christmas Eve candlelight service. And then follow the spiritual with the comedic, because we usually go to Christmas Eve candlelight service and then go to go back home and watch Elf by Will Ferrell, which just improves with age. So we go through the spiritual route and then we go the laugh route, and it's a great tradition.
Jonah,
I'm gonna look out for my own best interests here and say my wife's cooking.
She doesn't listen to this podcast.
No, but she'll get word. Word will go out. She, like my mom, is a big believer in the big traditional spreads, Christmas spread kind of thing. And she does things like Yorkshire pudding and my amazing popovers, various baked goods. We're going to do a standing rib roast. And I like to eat. I know that defies most of the most of the stereotypes about me, but so I would say the food, you know, I like food, Christmas food, holiday food. That's my favorite part of it, other than getting all the cool stuff.
I'm going to revive a Christmas tradition that we used to do growing up in Wisconsin. And I only know about it because a friend sent me a note that there has been this health warning sent out to Wisconsinites about doing this tradition again. And I didn't realize it was such a Wisconsin tradition. And that is steak tartare. Big thing at all of our holiday gatherings in Wisconsin, all the aunts and uncles. I was fortunate enough to live in close proximity to my mom's siblings. And so all of the cousins got together and we would just wolf down huge plates of steak tartare. And I haven't done it for a long time. I have a rule that if I go to a restaurant that serves steak tartare, I have to order it just to encourage them to continue serving steak tartare. But I had some the other night and I just had forgotten how great it is. So I'm going to reinstate that tradition and bring it to my own kids. We watch A Christmas Story at our house every year. Love doing that. We do a gift on Christmas Eve after church every year. I love doing that. And then recently we started going out. I don't even know how this one happened. We go to Maggiano's for a late Christmas Eve dinner with three groups of friends that, you know, some years you see them a lot, some years you see them infrequently, but you always see them then. And it's a new tradition that I love. So excited about that.
Well, this year we're excited to kind of start our Christmas traditions. Because Nate is 2.5 years old. It's going to be the first Christmas he understands any of this stuff. We don't really know how much, but he does keep saying that Santa is coming. Santa comes at night. Santa wears a red hat. He doesn't quite understand the reindeer yet. He calls Rudolph Red Nose, but we'll see. So I'm excited for whatever traditions might pop up this year. And with that, thank you all for all of your support during the year, for listening. We hope that you had an incredible and wonderful 2022, but we hope 2023 is even better. And that's when we're going to talk to you again. So until then, enjoy your holidays, enjoy time with family, time just reading a great book curled up somewhere, whatever it looks like for you and yours. And 2023, we'll see you then.
I wanted to say, until I remembered there was legitimate bad news in the world and a lot of it, that the bad news of 2022 was canceling Man of Steel 2 and the end of Henry Cavill as Superman. And then the news that Dwayne The Rock Johnson is not coming back as Black Adam anytime soon. Pretty devastating for a certain kind of nerd in the United States of America.
I hope you make it through. I really do. I'm pulling for
you. It's an open question. It's an open question.
Excellent.